last time, and the transparency projector wasn't working. So just to go back to something I was saying earlier, in fact, at the end of last week, what I told you was that the reason that perturbation theory in a quantum theory, in a quantum mechanical theory, the reason that it diverges is that there is the perturbation series is a series in powers of epsilon, so it's a Taylor-like series. So if a Taylor series diverges, it is because there's a singularity, and there's a singularity in the epsilon plane. So so in general, this, if we're calculating some energy in the form of a series of this type, what I said to you was that there's a singularity in the epsilon plane that causes this series to diverge. Okay. So in fact, writing an equal sign there is a little bit wrong. And what you really have to write is this, which means is asymptotic to, rather than is equal to. But I wanted to show you what the singularities really look like in the complex plane. Now, the model that I was talking about was the model of the anharmonic oscillator. And the potential for the anharmonic oscillator is x squared or x squared over 2, doesn't matter, plus epsilon, that's our perturbation parameter, times x to the fourth. Okay, and this perturbation, when you put an epsilon over here, the perturbation theory that you obtain is a singular perturbation theory. Okay, now, Cal, did you mention singular and regular perturbation? It's on the homework. Okay, so you emphasized in the tutorial that the difference between a regular perturbation theory and a singular perturbation theory is that in a regular perturbation theory, the series has at least a finite radius of convergence. In a singular perturbation theory, it typically has a zero radius of convergence. The way we tell the difference is whether or not there is an abrupt change in the vicinity of epsilon equals zero. Okay. And you can all see that there is an abrupt change in epsilon equals zero. I think you emphasized this, right?
It was on the homework.
So, yeah. Okay. So, well, in any case, to see that there's an abrupt change, it's very easy. When epsilon is positive, if you draw a plot of this potential, it looks like this, roughly. Okay? So it's a sum of a parabolic well and a quartic well. Okay, so it looks like this. When epsilon is less than zero, no matter how small it is in absolute value, if it is negative, eventually, when x gets big enough, this potential becomes large and negative. So it looks something like this. Okay? And so in this potential well, we have bound states. But in this potential well, we do not have bound states. We really have unstable states. And that's because these states can tunnel out to infinity. Okay, these things can just tunnel out. So these states are not time-independent bound states. Okay, so we see that there's an abrupt change in the vicinity of epsilon equals zero. That explains why this is a singular perturbation theory. It doesn't explain it, but it is a sort of heuristic way to understand it. Okay, well, so I wanted to take an example. It's rare, very rare in quantum mechanics to find a regular perturbation expansion, but here's an example of one. Suppose we take the Hamiltonian p squared over 2 plus x squared over 2 plus absolute x. Okay? And we argue, this problem I can solve exactly. And so I'm going to put a small parameter now in front of this potential. Now, this potential is a V-shaped potential. Okay, it's a V-shaped potential. And now, nothing abrupt happens as epsilon passes through zero. Okay, the potential is always a rising type potential. Okay, whether epsilon is positive or negative. And you always have bound states, whether epsilon is positive or negative. So I decided to ask some undergraduate students to take this Hamiltonian and go and look for singularities in the complex epsilon plane. Now, the only difference between these singularities and the singularities I showed you is that these singularities stay away from epsilon equals zero, because in this theory, there is a finite, non-zero radius of convergence. So in the complex epsilon plane, there is some region around epsilon equals zero that is free of singularities. But if you go far enough away, you'll find a bunch of singularities in the complex epsilon plane that determine the radius of convergence. Okay? And I told my undergraduate students to go and look for them, which is relatively easy to do. And they found four. I mean, they could have been, there are, in fact, an infinite number. But they found four of them. Now, see, somebody, you had a question. Yeah.
Yeah, if it's not absolute value in epsilon, though, so.
No, it's absolute value in x.
Right.
Yeah.
So, I mean, if you had negative epsilon, wouldn't it just be upside?
No. The total potential is x squared. This is the potential. That's V of x. Okay? So if epsilon is negative, x squared dominates over absolute x. So it's always rising. Of course, when epsilon gets to be negative, you know, it turns over, you know, it becomes a little bit negative down here, something like that. But that's, you don't lose any bound states. It's not as if the states suddenly become unstable and the particle starts tunneling off to infinity. Okay, so there's no abrupt change that occurs. So I told my students, go look for singularities. And they found four of them. Now, these are square root singularities. So what you see here is the upper, so let's draw it carefully. Here's the epsilon plane. And in this picture, you see this portion of the plane right here. That's what's pictured. Okay, so the origin is over here. Okay, and the singularities that are pictured here are in the upper left quadrant of the complex epsilon plane. And you see these, and they're marked A, B, C, and D. Okay, now, so for example, here is A. Okay, now these are square root singularities, and they're, as you know about square root singularities, there is a second square root singularity down here, but it isn't shown. And there is a branch cut that joins those two singularities. And then, in addition to A, there's B over here. And there is the companion, B, down here, B prime, with a branch cut. And there are lots of singularities here. Okay, there are many, many singularities. And what I then ask my students to do is to take a very careful walk through the complex plane to see what happened. Okay? So this is a memory test for you. Okay? You start at the origin, okay, and you go to the point 1, 2, 3, 4, 1, and back to the origin. Okay? Now, you notice what we're doing. We're going around this singularity and coming back again to the starting point. Okay? And so when we go around that singularity, you see that we have crossed the branch cut, and we're on a different sheet of the Riemann surface.
Just moving the mouse.
Okay. All right. Did it? Yeah. Good. Okay. So let's see what happens. So we're going to go again, start at the origin, go up to 1, 2, 3, 4, 1, back to 0. So let's see. Yeah. Okay. So this is the complex energy plane. And you know that, so at zero, so we started at epsilon equals zero. At epsilon equals zero, we have the harmonic oscillator. Okay? That's the harmonic oscillator. And the energy levels of the harmonic oscillator are 1/2, 3/2, 5/2, and so on. And what I'm plotting is just the even parity eigenvalues. The even parity eigenvalues. So the eigenvalues are at 1/2, 2.5, 4.5, and 6.5. Okay? And let's see what happens. So for example, the eigenvalue that begins at 6.5, when you take that trip in the complex epsilon plane, this eigenvalue moves. And it goes 1, 2, 3, 4, 1, and back to where it started. Nothing interesting happens. Okay? Let's look at this eigenvalue, the eigenvalue that starts at 4.5. It goes 1, 2, 3, 4, 1, back to the starting point. Nothing interesting happens. So you vary epsilon, and the energy varies. Big deal. Okay? When you return to zero, the energy returns. However, something very interesting happens. If you start at the ground state energy, it goes 1, 2, 3, 4, 1, and it returns to this energy level. Okay? On the other hand, if you start at this energy level, it goes 1, 2, 3, 4, 1, and returns to the ground state. So the two energy levels are analytic continuations of one another. They're not two different energy levels. They know about each other. One of them is the analytic continuation of the other. Okay? Very nice, simple calculation. Perfect calculation for an undergraduate student. Okay, just a numerical, just a computer calculation. Okay? Now, let's go back. Let me see if I can go. Okay, good. Now, let's ask what happens if we go around the point B. Okay? So now this is a harder memory test. We're going to start at the origin, and we're going to go 1, 2, 5, 6, 7, 8, 5, 2, 1, 0. Okay? And we're going to go around the point at B. And again, by going around the point at B, we are crossing that branch cut. If there's another branch cut here, you notice that we're crossing that branch cut twice. So there is, we're not crossing this branch cut one, you know, net time. We're crossing it and uncrossing it. Okay? But this branch cut we're crossing once. A net of one cross. Okay? So let's see what happens. Okay. So the energy level that starts at 6 goes 1, 2, 5, 6, 7, 8, 5, 2, 1, 0, and returns to where it started. Not interesting. Okay? And the ground state is also not interesting. The ground state starts 1, 2, 5, 6, 7, 8, 5, 2, 1, 0. Not very interesting. Okay? But apparently, the branch cut that emanates from B is the branch cut that controls the crossing of this energy level and that energy level. Okay? So, for example, if you start at the higher energy level, 4.5, it goes 1, 2, 5, 6, 7, 8, 5, 2, 1, 0, returns to the energy level at 2.5. And the energy level at 2.5 goes 1, 2, 5, 6, 7, 8, 5, 2, 1, 0. So again, now I've demonstrated that the second energy level and the third energy level are analytic continuations of one another if you cross the branch cut B, go around the branch point B. Okay? And let's see. So we can go around the other branch cuts, okay? For example, that's a very fancy branch cut. That you, to get there, you would go 1, 2, 5, 6, 7, 12, 13, 14, 15, 12, 7, 6, 5, 2, 1. Or to go around the point C, you have to remember the sequence 1, 2, 5, 6, 9, 10, 11, back down like this. Okay? And I will show you what it looks like quickly. Okay. So this is the one that goes around the point at 14. And again, you can see that, so here's the sequence, 1, 2, 5, 6, 7, 12, 13, 14, 15, 12, 7, 6, 5, 2, 1. So you notice this energy level doesn't do anything interesting. This energy doesn't do anything interesting. And now, once again, the first two eigenvalues are crossing. And you can see they're clearly crossing. This guy starts at 1, 2, 5, 6, 7, 12, 13, 14, 15, 12, 6, 5, 2, 1. Back to here. And you can see that they're switching like this. Okay, it's really nice. I'll show you what the other picture looks like. It looks like this. And it's not immediately obvious, I think, which two energy levels have crossed. You have to study this picture for a while. It's kind of complicated. It's all sort of on top of one another. But I assure you that here, two energy levels have crossed one another, and the other two energy levels have not. Okay, this is pretty hard to tell. Okay. Now, let me see. So I wanted to show you that. Now, let me see. So how do we... There's no... The mouse doesn't work. Where is it? Oh, I see. I get it. Okay. Good. Okay. Right. Okay. Now, what I wanted... So, I want to return back. These are things I showed you. Okay. Okay, so I want to return to what we were talking about last time. And I just wanted to mention in passing, because actually we've had some discussions at lunch about these issues, there are summation schemes that do not respect the two axioms that I just made up. Okay? And they're interesting. I must say that I personally don't like them all that much. But I don't know, that's not a word that really works in physics, right? I mean, like or not like. But zeta summation is a technique that is used very often. This is the zeta function. That's the definition of the zeta function. Zeta function is a function of S, zeta of S. And that's the definition of the zeta function. It's the sum of the reciprocals of the integers raised to the power s. And s, in general, can be a complex number. Okay? And zeta of s, as a function of complex s, is analytic so long as the real part of s is greater than 1. And that's because that series converges if the real part of s is greater than 1. Okay? And there's a singularity at s equals 1. Here is s equals 1. Zeta of 1 is equal to 1 plus a half plus a third. And this is the so-called harmonic series. And it's equal to infinity. And indeed, the zeta function is equal to infinity at 1. Okay. So if you used zeta summation to try to sum the series 1 plus a half plus a third by saying that the sum of that series is the analytic continuation of zeta of s to s equals 1, zeta summation would say zeta of 1, the harmonic series, is infinity. And I have no problem with that. It's infinity. Okay? That series happens to add up to infinity. However, if you go around the singularity at 1 and go down to s equals 0, you find that the analytic continuation of the zeta function, that is, the value of zeta of 0, is not singular. Of course, the series doesn't converge, but the series is just a representation of the zeta function. It just represents the zeta function. The zeta function itself exists. The representation of it doesn't exist. okay, the series representation. But if you analytically continue to the point at s equals 0, what you find, and then you claim that you have summed the series, what you conclude is that the series 1 plus 1 plus 1 plus 1 is the value of zeta of 0, which happens to be minus a half, which disagrees with what you would get from our summation machines that we were talking about last time. And that's because zeta summation does not respect the two axioms that we posed. Okay. Similarly, zeta of minus 1, which is 1 plus 2 plus 3 plus 4, if you analytically continue the zeta function to the value minus 1, you see that the answer is minus a 12th. Okay? Now, in general, when you're summing a series, you are doing an analytic continuation. Okay, so for example, if I said to you, take the series 1 plus a squared plus a cubed, and I said to you, what is this series equal to? You know what you would do. You would say, first, let's assume that a, in absolute value, is less than 1, so that this series converges. And then you would sum the series, because it's just a geometric series, and you'd get 1 over 1 minus a. Okay. And then if someone walked up to you and said, what is 1 plus 2 plus 4 plus 8 and so on, okay, plus and so on, what is that? You would say, let me simply analytically continue the function 1 over 1 minus a to the value at a, to its value at a equals 2. Of course, the series doesn't converge, okay? So this representation of that function is breaking down, okay? But the function exists. And what we can do is analytically continue this function around the singularity. So the point is, in the complex A-plane, there's a singularity at 1, and what we can do is simply go around the singularity. This function exists past the singularity, even though the series doesn't converge. And at a equals 2, for example, you can see that this is minus 1, which is the result that we got last time for the sum of that series, okay? So what I want you to understand is that when we sum a series, in the background, whether you see it or not, whether you see it or not, there are complex numbers involved, and there is an analytic continuation involved, okay? Now, of course, this singularity is just, what do you call this singularity? What is the nature of that singularity?
Pole.
It's a pole, that's right, it's a pole. And therefore, in the vicinity of a pole, the function is single-valued. Okay? But it could be a branch cut, could well have been a branch cut, in which case there would be a branch cut over here. And now, if we analytically continue to the point at 2, there are two possible answers, right? If we analytically continue around this way, we get one answer. If we continue around this way, we get a different answer. Okay, and that's because on the two sides of the branch cut, the function is not continuous. Furthermore, the function would be complex. Okay, so the sum of this series, which might be a sum of just real numbers, might well be complex. Unless, of course, your summation machine does this and this and averages them, something like that. Okay, and only then would it be real. Okay, so summation is a process that's very interesting, and it involves the complex plane. Okay, and the two axioms that I gave you last time, you can accept them or not accept them. That's up to you. Okay, but I wanted to show you that at least there's some sense, some uniqueness, some universality when we start summing divergent series. Okay, and you're going to see that in a more serious way in physical applications very soon. But you had somebody had a question.
So for series that converge in a non-zero radius disk, is there a sense in which each summation machine is a different way of analytically continuing?
Well, the point, of course, of a summation machine is that it is an analytic continuation. If it's working right, it is analytically, it has the effect of analytically continuing the function outside of its circle of convergence. That's the effect of summation.
Right.
Well, okay. But of course, it's a little bit more subtle than that, because there might not even be a circle of convergence. That is, the radius of that circle may, to begin with, may well be zero, in which case this is very interesting. Okay, and that's the case in physics. Okay, it's the case with Feynman diagram series. Yeah?
The divergence series may give different answers whether we use a zeta summation or...
Yes.
If that is the case, then you know, the last series is very, very important, something important string theory, for example.
That's right. Both of these series, in particular the last one, is very important because this series typically appears whenever you're summing over modes. So in string theory, you're summing over the modes of vibration of the string. If you were studying the Casimir force, you would be summing over the modes, the vacuum modes. Okay, and again, you use this summation procedure. But it's very hard to justify. Why? I mean, you see how you justify it. You say zeta of s is this, no problem with that. Then you say this representation breaks down, of course, when the real part of s is equal to 1 or less, such as, for example, minus 1. Okay? And then you analytically continue in s, and you reinterpret this as that. Okay, well, that's sleazy, and I don't know how to justify it. I simply don't know. Okay, yeah. It's, you know, and of course, there are other kinds of continuation techniques, and that is dimensional regulation, where you take a Feynman diagram whose Feynman integral is divergent, and then you insert D. You say, let us pretend that we're doing this calculation in D dimensions, where D is, say, less than 2. Okay, where the integral converges, and then you analytically continue in D. Is that justified? It's very hard to justify. Okay, people do it all the time, and this is a deep and subtle question. Okay? But I am going to justify it for some physical problems that we're going to talk about, because I want to ground this in something real, okay, something really rigorous. Okay, so... What is the problem? In everything I've told you, it is sort of, I guess you could call what the lecture I gave you last time is a sort of recreational mathematics type lecture. Because what we were doing was picking out various strange divergent series and summing them and assigning in some sort of reasonable, coherent way the sum of the series. But in real life, you're not doing recreational mathematics. What you're doing is physics, okay? And when you're trying to solve a hard physics problem, typically you're doing it by summing Feynman diagrams or by doing a very deep perturbative calculation. And you can only find maybe 4 or 5 terms in the series. In all the calculations we did yesterday, we knew every term in the series. The series might be 1, minus 1, plus 1, minus 1, and so on. And we knew all the terms in the series out to infinity. In some sense, that sort of a problem is a trivial problem. Because in real life, you can never know all the terms in the series. In fact, in real life, you're lucky to know 3 or 4 terms in the series. And if you know 5 or 6 terms, you're really lucky. That's an impressively simple problem you're working on. So the question is, how do we extract the sum of a divergent series when you only know a few terms in the series? And the general approach is to use continued functions. And that's what I'm going to start talking to you about. And of course, the most important kind of continued function is a pade, which is a continued fraction. And we're going to talk about continued fractions. Now, you have studied already. You've seen continued fractions, right? You've had some experience. So that's very good. But I'm going to try to present it in a sort of a novel way. But what I want to do before we look at continued functions, before we look at continued fractions, is I want to look at continued exponentials, okay? And let me, where's the... Because that's a really strange idea. But you'll see what I mean by a continued function, okay? So I would like first to talk to you about continued exponentials. So imagine you have a Taylor-like series. And to begin with, let's assume that this series has a non-zero radius of convergence. So imagine that you have a series of the form sum equals sum from n equals 0 to infinity, a sub n, x to the n, okay? And this series converges in the complex x-plane in a circle where there is a radius of convergence r. So this converges for absolute x less than r, okay? So this is the region of convergence. Now, what I claim is that if you convert this Taylor series into a continued function representation, it will not converge in a circle. And if you're lucky, it will converge in a region bigger than that circle. So what do I mean by that? Well, let's use a continued exponential. So what would a continued exponential be? Well, let's take a let's convert this thing into the following form. Let's say b0 e to the b1 x e to the b2 x e to the b3 x e to the b4 x, and so on. Okay? Now, how do you do that? How do you make this conversion? That's easy. All you need to do is to truncate this infinite continued exponential, say, after three terms, you know, after the third iteration, and then expand this into a Taylor series. Okay? So if you expand this into a Taylor series, the first term, of course, is b0, and then you have another term, you know, alpha times x plus beta times x squared, and so on. And all you do is compare the coefficients in this series with the coefficients in this series, do a trivial algebraic calculation, and determine b0, b1, b2, b3, and so on. Okay? Do you all understand that? So this is just trivial arithmetic. You expand this into Taylor series, compare this series with this series, set the coefficients in the series equal term by term, and then you simply solve some algebraic equations, and you know the coefficients in this series. Now, why do such a thing? Because I claim that a continued function, now this, of course, could be a continued square root, it could be a continued logarithm, could be a continued fraction, could be continued anything, continued cube root, okay, continued sine function. You know, it could be sine, it could be b0 sine of b1x sine of b2x sine of b3, and so on. It doesn't matter what function we're continuing, but the claim is that it may well turn out that this object converges in a region bigger than a circle. Could be. And in the case of continued exponentials, it does. And what is really interesting is that when this converges, it typically does not converge in a circle. It might converge in a rectangle, or it might converge in a cardioid. Okay? And typically that cardioid will contain the circle. Okay? It's quite interesting, quite remarkable. So here is the game. So what I'm going to do, I guess I switched the coefficients. So, sorry about that. So the Taylor series has the form cnz to the n. The continued exponential has the form a0 plus e times e to the a1z times e to the a2z and e to the, and so on. Okay? And if you expand this into a Taylor series and compare coefficients, you get these algebraic equations to solve. And I wonder, I guess, let me point out that these equations are triangular. In the following sense, what I mean by that is, if you know the first term in the Taylor series, C0, then you automatically know the first term in the continued exponential. If you know the first and the second terms in the Taylor series, then you know the first and the second terms in the continued exponential. Okay? Because you already know A0, so now you solve this equation for A1. And you notice, by the way, that the solution is unique. Once you know A0, which is obtained from a linear equation, you now know everything in this equation except A1. And again, you solve a linear equation. So the solution is unique. There are no spurious solutions coming in, no multiple solutions. Now you go to the next term. We know A0, and we know A1, and now somebody tells you C2. That is to say, you send your graduate student home, and you say, work for the next 3 weeks and calculate the third term in the perturbation expansion. So your student very dutifully does, very hardworking student, comes back and tells you A2, the coefficient of epsilon squared, okay, the coefficient here, okay, and you plug it in, okay, or C2 here, and you plug it in, you already know A1 and A0, and the only thing you don't know in this equation is A2, so it's clear that every time you learn a new coefficient in the Taylor series, you learn a new coefficient in the continued exponential. Okay, so I have to say, I worked fairly hard because I wanted to find an example where I knew all, just to give you a clear demonstration. I mean, it's obvious these algebraic equations are getting more and more complicated, and I tried to find an example where I could learn, where I would know exactly all of the C's and all of the A's. That is, all of the coefficients in the Taylor series and all of the coefficients in this continued exponential. And I only found one example. If you could find another example, I would be really impressed. Okay? But the one example I found was this. Suppose all of these coefficients A0, A0, A1, A2, and so on, are all equal to 1. Okay? Then the coefficient C has a remarkable form. C sub n is equal to n plus 1 to the n minus 1 power over n factorial. And I have never seen a bunch of series coefficients that have this strange form, but this is the exact answer. Okay? And that I found just by fiddling. You can just fiddle and fiddle and fiddle until you find something. And so what this means is that if you had this, I don't want to use the wrong notation here. So suppose for just, here's the scenario. You are doing a perturbative calculation. You have found, using perturbation theory, these coefficients, okay, and you now, you would like, and you know that this series only converges in a circle, okay? The radius of the circle, by the way, is 1 over e. Okay, can you see that? Because this is a factorial. Okay, so this n factorial, if you ask, how does this behave? N factorial behaves like n to the n, e to the minus n, right? When n is large, this is roughly n to the n. So the n to the n's cancel, and so the nth coefficient in the Taylor series goes roughly like e to the n. So the radius of convergence, of the Taylor series is 1 over e. Is all that clear? So this Taylor series converges in a circle in the complex plane whose radius is 1 over e. Can you extend that? Can you perform a summation machine, some sort of clever summation machine, to continue this series outside of its circle of convergence? Well, I claim that if you convert this series with these coefficients into the continued exponential e to the x, e to the x, e to the x, e to the x, where all these coefficients are 1, 1, 1, 1, 1, that this converges in a larger region, and I'll show you the larger region. Okay? So the region, so this is the identity, okay? When this exists, and when this exists, these two are equal. This exists inside of a circle of radius 1 over e, but the question is, where does this exist? And here's the picture. Okay, so here is the circle of radius 1 over e. But the continued exponential exists inside of this beautiful cardioid lying on its side. So in other words, if you were supposed to calculate the perturbation coefficients and get this perturbation series, and then at the end of the calculation, you were supposed to set epsilon equals minus 1, you can't do that, because minus 1 is bigger in absolute value than 1 over e. 1 over e is just about 0.3, right? So it's bigger. So it doesn't exist. But this cardioid extends all the way down to, actually, the point minus e, which is quite interesting. Okay, so, for example, at minus 1 or at minus 2, which is way outside of the circle of convergence, the continued exponential still converges. So here's the scenario. You send off your student calculates a bunch of these c's, you realize that you're outside of the circle of convergence, so you use some simple algebra and convert this to a continued exponential, boom, 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 boom. The continued exponential converges, and that's how you extract the sum of the series outside of its radius of convergence. Okay? Now, is that all clear? Okay, it's quite beautiful and quite amazing, and this is the region in which it converges. By the way, it doesn't. A continued exponential doesn't always converge in this region. You notice that there's an indentation right here. That's because the singularity that causes the Taylor series to diverge is right here. Okay, right there. However, it could be that there are two singularities that cause the Taylor series to diverge, one here and one here, in which case the continued exponential would converge in a double cardioid. It would converge in a region that looks something like this. It would go into here all the way around, out into here all the way around, and into here. So it would have two indentations. Or it could even have three indentations. It could go around like this, around, and make a tree foil. Okay? Yeah?
Do the continuations depend heavily on which functions you choose to use for your continuation?
Yes. So for example, if you have a continued exponential, typically you have a region that has indentations like this. Okay? If you use the square root, I don't know what happens. You could experiment with that.
But
okay,
the
I don't
values
have a
agree,
what is that?
Do the values agree?
Do the values
agree?
Well, it depends what you mean when you say the values agree. Inside of the circle, the two are identical. They're equal, okay? The two of them are equal. That's what I showed you here. Okay, inside the circle, it is true that this continued exponential converges, this Taylor series converges, and they're equal. They converge to exactly the same number. Outside of the circle of convergence, the Taylor series doesn't exist. But it defines a function. Okay, the continued exponential defines, the Taylor series defines a function. And if I follow that function now, the function exists, the Taylor series ceases to exist outside the circle. If I continue that function outside of the circle, the Taylor series no longer exists. The continued exponential does exist, and it converges to that function.
So if I say use continued square roots, they should give me, and it converges on this overlap with the continued exponential, it should give me the same values?
It should give you the same value, that's right. Although the function may be multiple valued, in which case the square root may also be multiple. It could be very interesting. Okay, I mean, this is a, by the way, what I'm talking about is on the is really a research topic. Okay? So some of the questions you're going to ask me, I'm going to know the answers to. And some of them, all I can say is write a paper. Okay, so in the case of, say, continued square roots or continued cube roots, I don't know how well they've been studied. Probably not very well. It would be a very interesting research project to find out really what does happen and what does the region look like. It surely doesn't look something like this. And I don't know, in the case of continued square roots, what the region of convergence would look like. But typically, it will be bigger than the circle of convergence for the Taylor series. Okay, and the region, the shape of the region is characterized, you know, by the fact that you're using a continued square root or a continued logarithm or whatever. Okay, now, I then wanted to show you something entertaining, which I think is really interesting. I asked an undergraduate student, we know that the continued exponential converges inside of this cardioid-shaped region. But the question is, what happens outside of the cardioid-shaped region? Now, if you were evaluating a Taylor series outside of its radius of convergence, what does the Taylor series do? If you keep adding terms in the Taylor series, it goes off to infinity, right? Blows up. And that's because the terms in the Taylor series are growing exponentially, growing geometrically. And so the Taylor series just diverges. It equals infinity. Okay? But it is not necessarily true that a continued exponential is equal to infinity outside of its region of convergence. We understand what is meant by convergence, but what is happening when it's not converging? And it is fascinating, absolutely fascinating. So this is what my undergraduate student did. He took the points in the complex plane and assigned them to pixels on his computer. Okay? So for each pixel on his computer, he tested the convergence. And what he found was this, which is stunning, I think. This is truly beautiful. This took about a month or 6 weeks, something like that, of, or maybe even more, of computer time on his computer. And this is the upper half of the cardioid. You see this blue here? The cardioid, this is the indentation of the cardioid. This is the real axis here. Okay, this is the point where the indentation is. This is the point 1 over e. And this is the point minus e. Okay, and the other half of the cardioid is below. So we're only looking at the upper half complex plane. So this is the region of convergence. But outside of this region of convergence, you see different colors here. In this red region, if you take a point in this region and you just continue, you know, e to the z, e to the z, e to the, you just keep doing that, what happens is it approaches, it doesn't diverge to infinity, but rather it approaches a two-cycle. Okay, so rather than the converging to one limit, it converges to two limits. Okay, and each different color corresponds to the number of limits in the cycle. So it doesn't go off to infinity. But rather, it except on the real axis here. On the real axis, just gets bigger because you continue to exponentiate more and more and more. It gets bigger and bigger and goes off to infinity. But other than that, it converges to n cycles. So this is a 4-cycle and a 5-cycle and a 6-cycle and a 7-cycle and so on. And he went all the way up to 12 cycles. And of course, this took a lot of computer time. And the reason is that you have to compute for an extremely long time to know that, for example, you're in a 12 cycle. Okay, so the points get closer and closer and closer to a 12 cycle. Because it goes boom, 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 boom. Okay? And it gets closer and closer to that 12 cycle, and you have to do this, you know, thousands of times with extremely high numerical precision. You have to keep hundreds of decimal places to be sure. So this is a non-trivial, and of course, it's all complex calculation. So it's non-trivial. Now, what you see is little crescent-shaped regions here. Those crescent-shaped regions are not where this region ends. That's where his computer died. Okay? So outside of this crescent, he simply was unable to determine anything. So black means too hard for the computer to determine. But in fact, you can show that these regions are actually like tadpoles, and they're infinitely long. So every region seems to end in a crescent. See the little crescent here and a little crescent here. The region doesn't end there. The region continues, and it continues on, and it gets exponentially thin. And every single region is a tadpole with an infinitely long tail. Okay. So for example, this tadpole here has a tail that comes out through here and runs off parallel to the real axis. See this blue region? It comes out through here, and runs off. And eventually, you have, as you go off to the right, an infinite number of tadpoles with infinitely thin tails, which are the tail end of all of these regions. Okay? You also notice that this cardioid has one indentation, and this red region has an indentation there and another one below, two indentations. And as you go higher and higher up, you find multiple indentations, which are the reflection of this indentation. So there's a purple one here having an indentation, another one. So all these little indentations are reflected in these higher and higher regions. Absolutely stunning piece of work, in my opinion. Guy went off and did his PhD at Princeton. Sorry to lose the guy. Very, very smart guy. So that gives you a feeling, an interesting feeling, about continued functions. They're very elaborate. They're very interesting. They can generate fractal-like structures. So this is really fascinating stuff. Yeah. Well, you do a numerical test, okay? So you set a condition on the computer. So you let it run, and you can clearly see it converging. It's getting closer and closer and closer to a number. If you're not sure if it's really getting closer to a number, you have a sequence. You know, at first it's bouncing around, and then it settles down and appears to be approaching a number. If you're not sure whether it's approaching a number, you know what to do. You do Richardson extrapolation. Okay? So you plug in the last 20 numbers you got. You do a 20-fold Richardson extrapolation. Okay? And then you see whether or not it is really converging. And you can see it if you do a 20-fold Richardson extrapolation with the raw numbers, say it is only converged, let's say, in the 10th place. But when you do a Richardson extrapolation, you'll see it's converging in the 100th place. So it's very easy to do a numerical test. So these are just extrapolation, typical numerical extrapolation. Very easy to do that, very easy to test. OK, of course, proving it is something else. But I never prove anything. So I'm very happy with a numerical demonstration. OK, so now we get to the main. So this was just to sort of tantalize you, but now I'm going to introduce the main topic, and this has to do with continued fractions and Pade theory. How many of you have heard of Pade theory? So some of you have heard. Pade theory is not understood. It is understood for a limited class of functions called Borel summable functions and Stieltjes functions. And I'm going to try to introduce to you continued fractions and Pade theory. I'm going to try to do so using a novel approach. And so I'm going to do this. I like sort of dreaming up teaching tricks. So I'm going to try a teaching trick on you. I'm going to give you an IQ test. Okay. And as you all know, when you have an IQ test, you're asked, what's the next number in the sequence? Okay, so for example, if someone gave you this sequence here, do you know the next number in that sequence? 14, 34, 42, 72, 96, 110, 116. What's the next number in that sequence? And why? Not a single person knows. It's 125. You don't know? Okay, I'll help you out. These are the express stops on the 7th Avenue line in New York City, okay. Going uptown. Okay, so you didn't get that at all. All right, so I'll try this one. Okay, so what's the next? This is a serious question. What is the next number in this sequence? Do any of you know these numbers? 1, 5, 61? Do you know them?
You know of them?
Do you?
Quick, somebody get out Sloan.
What is that?
Somebody, we have computers, just like get on Sloan, we can easily figure it out.
Yes. If you look on your computer, you will find this is a serious sequence. The next number happens to be 1385. Not at all obvious. Okay? And the question is, how could you have realized that the next number in this sequence is 1385? This is a sequence of numbers. These are called the Euler numbers. They're very important numbers. They appear throughout mathematics, okay, in number theory, but also in analysis. And so the question is, how could you have predicted the next number? And I want to show you a technique for actually doing so, which I'm rather proud of coming up with, because I think it leads naturally into continued fractions, although it isn't at all obvious. So I want to indicate to you how you would find the next number in this sequence. Ignore this one, but this is a serious one. These numbers, by the way, grow like 2n factorial. So they're very rapidly growing, not like worse than n factorial. They grow like 2n. Okay. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to say, let's call these numbers a sub n. So you're trying to guess the next number in the sequence a sub n, where a1 is 1, and then a2 is 5, and a3 is 61. And I claim that if you do this right, a4 will be 1385, and so on. Okay, very rapidly, very rapidly growing numbers. Now, the way we're going to solve this problem is we're going to perform a nonlinear transform on this sequence, and we're going to generate another sequence of numbers, bn. And I claim that the bn numbers are going to be much easier to guess, and the reason that they're going to be easier to guess is that they're going to grow much less rapidly than the a sub n. So they're going to be slowly growing, and we're going to be able to recognize the numbers b sub n. So to generate the numbers b sub n, it requires three simple steps. Okay. Now, step one. Okay, one. Given the numbers a sub n, I want you to imagine that a sub n is equal to the 2nth moment of some weight function w. So it's an integral from some number to some other number. I don't know what this number L is. I have no idea. Dx times w of x times x to the 2n. So it's the 2nth moment of some weight function w. We can imagine this weight function is an even function of x. Okay? Now, that's step one. I definitely did not ask you to take these numbers and determine w. That would require that you solve what is called the moment problem, and you can't do that. That's a very, very, very hard problem. Okay? I'm merely asking you to imagine that A sub n is the 2nth moment of some weight function w that you don't know yet. Okay, have you done it? Good. That's it. You've just imagined it. You don't have to do anything. You just have to imagine that. Okay? Now here comes step two. Okay, step two consists of this. I want you to imagine that you had a sequence of numbers bn, that is b1, b2, b3, and so on. Okay? Now you haven't got those numbers yet, but I want you to imagine that you had them. If you had these numbers, then you could imagine creating a sequence of polynomials, p sub n of x, using the following technique. Let's assume that p0 of x is 1, and p1 of x is x. All right? And you could imagine that if you knew the numbers b sub n, which you don't, but if you did, you could imagine defining the n plus first polynomial to be x times the nth polynomial minus bn times the n minus first polynomial. OK, this is a two-term recursion relation, so I need to tell you p0 and p1. And once you know this, you could construct these polynomials. For example, if I asked you what is p2 of x, you know what p2 is. P2 would be x times p1, which would be x squared, minus b1 times p0, which is b1. Okay? So this would be p2 of x. p3 of x would be x times p2, which would be x cubed minus x b1, minus b2 times p1, which is x. Okay? And so on. So can you imagine doing that? Of course you can. You've just imagined it. Okay? So if you knew the numbers b, which we are looking for, then you could imagine constructing these polynomials. There's only one more step. Does anybody have a guess what we're going to do in the third step? You understand that the first step says that you should imagine something having to do with A. The second step says you have to imagine something to do with B. But we don't yet have a connection between A and B. How are we going to establish the connection between A and B? Say it again.
Polynomial converges to W?
No. What do you do when you have a set of polynomials? I mean, what is interesting typically about polynomials? Say it again?
The roots.
There are two interesting things about polynomials. One of them is roots, but that's much too complicated for us. Okay. What's the other thing? Yeah.
Do we need to try to make them orthogonal?
Brilliant. Okay. Exactly right. So what we're going to require in step three is that the polynomials Pn, we're going to require that these are orthogonal with respect to W. Now, we don't know W, so that sounds like a ridiculous thing to do. We have no idea what the function W is, but I'm going to require that they be orthogonal with respect to W. Okay? So let's see what happens. For example, suppose we require that p0 and p1 are orthogonal. Ah, but they're already orthogonal with respect to w, simply because w is an even function, and this integral would be odd. That's nothing. So where is the first interesting thing we can do? Well, we can require that p0 be orthogonal to p2 with respect to w. So we take p0 and multiply it by p2, and then we multiply by w, and we integrate from minus l to l. Of course, we don't know what l is, but we do it anyway. Okay? So the integral of the first term, you know what that's going to give me. That gives me a1. Do you see that? It gives me just a 1. By definition, the integral of w times x squared would be a 1. Now, the integral of the second term gives you just the integral of w. And we will, just for laughs, we'll say a 0, which is the integral from minus l to l of w dx, is just defined to be 1 without loss of generality. We can say that. And so therefore, I get minus b1. So the statement of orthogonality is that this is 0, and I obtain the equation a1 equals b1. This is very nice. And I found that equation without knowing w, because I can never know w. That's a very hard problem. OK. Now, let's just derive the second equation. Yes, you have a question.
First, we specify a in terms of w, and then we write.
No, we don't specify a in terms of w. We say we're given a. We're given a sequence like this sequence here. So we're given the a's. And all I told you was to imagine that these a's happen to be the 2nth moments of some function w from some number to some number. Of course, we don't know that number, and we don't know w. So it's just something you can imagine. But it doesn't matter. OK?
I was just going to ask you whether defining this as the first condition and then also the orthogonality, are we overspecifying?
No. This is only about A. This is only about B. If I had the numbers B, I could generate a set of polynomials. Nothing to do with A. So step 2 is only about B, not
step
about
three.
Step 3, oh, I understand your question. That's right. It may be that this is an overdetermined question, OK? But it isn't. And that is the remarkable thing. Obviously, as we have more and more polynomials, we're going to have many, many conditions. But they will all be satisfied. And I want you to do in your practice, and maybe I'll do it also tomorrow morning, I'll show you that this is, you don't have a tutorial today. Right. But you will see that, in fact, nothing here is overdetermined. Everything is exactly determined. Okay. But let me just do one more calculation before we quit. Let's require, for example, that P1, which is written over here, is orthogonal to P3. Let's require that P1 is orthogonal to P3. Okay? So I multiply this times this. And what I get, the first term is x to the 4. And when I integrate, I get a2. Over here, I get minus x squared times b1 plus b2. So I get minus b1 plus b2, okay, times x squared. But when I integrate x squared, I get a1. And the condition of orthogonality is that this be 0. And therefore, I see that a2 is equal to b1 plus b2 times a1. But we already said that a1 is b1. So that's the next equation. a2 is equal to b1 plus b2 times b1. OK? Now, it will take you absolutely not more than 5 minutes to do the following calculation. Calculate p4. Require that p4 is orthogonal to p0. It already will be. You will learn nothing new. Then require that p4 is orthogonal to p2. And that will give you a new condition. And the condition is something like a3 is equal to b1, b2, b3 plus b1 plus b2 squared times b1, something like that. That's the equation. Okay. Now, the numbers a are very complicated. But we can plug it into these equations here and find the numbers b. If the number a is 1, the number b1 is, from this equation, 1. If the number A2 is 5, then you can see the number B2. What's B2? 4. Uh-huh. So B2 is 4. If the number A3 is 61, from this equation, if the number A3 is 61, you notice that this is already 1 plus 4, which is 5, squared, which is 25, which you subtract from 61, which gives you 36. And B2 is 4, therefore B3 is 9. And if I walked up to you on the street and I said 1, 4, 9, what's the next number? Aha! This isn't a very difficult IQ test at all. And indeed, B4 comes out to be 16. And the point, there are several points to be made here. One is that the numbers B are growing like, are growing algebraically in n, are growing like n squared. The numbers A, which are terribly complicated and non-obvious, the Euler numbers, the very famous Euler numbers, which you could never remember, okay, are growing like 2n factorial. You can, so now you know the sequence of b's, it's obvious. You can solve the IQ test, however, by just transforming back. Okay, so you just calculate one more polynomial, you get one more algebraic formula, and you can derive the number 1385. Okay, this is the target number, and you'll see that it's true, that you will get that target number. Okay, now, the question is, this is very cute, but does this have any significance? What I'm going to show you next time is that this has deep significance, because although I haven't told you so, what we just did was a continued fraction, okay? And the continued fraction is deeply connected to a pade, and this IQ test is nothing but the statement that you're expanding a function in a continued fraction, although it's not at all obvious at this point, okay? So that much I will show you right away at the beginning of next lecture. But fiddle with this. This is really fun. In some sense, what you're doing here is you're looking at something very complicated when you look at the A's. And when you construct the number B's, it's as if you're looking at a very complicated human cell. And when you construct the number B's, you're finding the chromosome that determines the structure of that cell. And that is a very simple rule for constructing that cell. So you're breaking a set of complicated numbers into simple numbers. And what we have done here is a little bit like a Fourier transform. You know, you have a hard problem, you Fourier transform it into an easy problem, you solve the easy problem, and you Fourier transform back again. But the thing is that a Fourier transform is a linear operation, okay, or a Laplace transform. It's a linear operation. This is a very fancy, implicit, nonlinear operation, okay? And what is the most remarkable thing about this is that we never have calculated W. We don't know W. It would be much too hard to try and calculate W. And yet, we can derive all of these equations with no problem. Yeah?
This technique works for other series?
Oh, yes. Lots of series. You can play with it. Okay. In fact, a long time ago, I wrote a paper and made a whole list of series. For example, another very complicated set of numbers is the Bernoulli numbers. Do you know, have you heard of them? Bernoulli numbers, they're used all the time. They appear all the time in analysis. And they appear when you do numerical integration and so on. Okay? If you take the Bernoulli numbers and you do this trick, you can, Bernoulli numbers are very complicated. You can't look at them and predict the next number. It's hopeless. Okay? It's like this series. Okay? And you can find a simple formula that will generate the Bernoulli numbers. And you could take lots and lots and lots of sets of numbers, very complicated sets of numbers. Okay. In general, the thing to remember is that if these A's grow like a factorial, which in physics, when you sum a Feynman series, they do. These numbers, these are the perturbation coefficients. They grow like a factorial. These numbers are just growing algebraically. Okay. And so you can either guess them or at least find that these numbers are much smaller and much simpler.
Mm-hmm. Can we continue to do this for Bn?
Can we?
continue.
Sure. Oh, yeah, of course. So you can generate these numbers and continue working. Okay. You will find these formulas.
You mean make another, find CNs.
Right.
Yeah.
Oh, you mean starting from the Bs, do you want to do it again? In principle, you could. However, you lose the benefit. The real benefit of this is that when the numbers are A are growing like a factorial, the numbers B are growing linearly with n. When the numbers A grow like 2n factorial, the numbers B grow like n squared. If the numbers A grow like 3n factorial, like just grow at a fantastic rate, the numbers B grow like n cubed, and so on. So it's a way of converting a factorial, which is a very rapidly growing sequence of numbers, into a much less rapidly growing sequence of numbers. Okay? Okay, so next time I will show you the connection between this and continued fractions and pod data. Okay?